Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is currently at 1 p.m. and that is Pacific Standard Time. Well, when we look at what's been going on in the markets, there is a lot to talk about. But what I want to focus on for this broadcast is the long term, because I think if we start to break down the various time frames that people think about markets. Well, there's the short term, and the way we define that is anything from a few weeks to a few months, maybe 6 months. The medium term is anything from 6 months up to about 3 to 5 years. And then the long term can be anything from 5 years and onwards. So we've had a bull market for 9 years, and it is one of the most impressive in terms of length, but perhaps not as impressive in terms of magnitude. But something that has been very clearly evident over the course of the last 4 or 5 years is that the yield curve spread has been contracting, and that is representative of the punch bowl being withdrawn. There are a number of reasons why we should pay attention to the yield curve. And every time we get down to these very narrow levels, there's always an argument about what exactly we can, what conclusions we can draw on this occasion. Well, the simple rationale for looking at the yield curve is that the banking sector thrives on liquidity. It's a liquidity provider. It, when there is ample demand for liquidity and they have the capacity to lend, then they make a nice profit by lending long and borrowing short. And that works wonderfully well when there's a wide spread between both ends of the curve. And we had that all the way from 2009 through to about 2013. The average spread between the long and the short end of the curve was over 200 basis points. And on occasion was almost 300 basis points, but it's currently 15. Well, that tells us that there is a lot less money to be made by borrowing short and lending long, and that crimps the ability of banks to make money. So that's certainly one important factor. If all other things being equal, the fact that the yield curve spread has contracted so much over the course of the last 18 months in particular should give us some reason for pause, because when it becomes inverted, then banks stop making money altogether. And that's, or at least from their primary business activities. Now, there is a long lead time before that drying up of credit really moves into the wider economy, because any projects that have had finance confirmed, well, they'll continue to go ahead, but those that will be seeking funding later will have a much more difficult time. So there is definitely a lag between when you get an inverted yield curve and when you get a recession, but they do tend to follow one after the other. And one of the things that we've seen over the course of the last few months has been that different parts of the yield curve have been inverted. So the 5 year and the 2 year have been inverted. And when we look at the near term spread, then we're presented with a very similar condition that's also become inverted. Well, you have to look at it on a daily basis to see the inversion quite recently, because it happened just for 3 days. But it was inverted. And I also prepared the TIPS spread, and that's the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year TIPS, and it became inverted earlier this year, well, in the middle of 2018, in fact. So what that, I think, very clearly signals is that we are in the latter stages of this economic expansion. That's when we think then, is that short, medium, or long term? Well, it's certainly anywhere from medium to long term in terms of thinking, because we know that the market has been expanding. But it's, I think it's also, it really is worth our while thinking about what exactly do we mean by the market, because the hallmark of the era of quantitative easing has been defined by the liquidity-fueled rallies we've seen in a substantial number of asset classes. So when we say the market, what we're really talking about is almost everything that it has got some form of physical representation in the wider world. So the shares of stocks, bonds, art, property, all of that, all of those assets have had their prices inflated as a result of quantitative easing. And when we think about the latter stages of a bull market, well, the fact of the matter is that what we have right now is the biggest contraction in the size of central bank balance sheets that we have, we've got history for. It's been certainly the biggest in the last 16 years. The relative weakness of the dollar over the course of the last 6 weeks has enabled this measure to expand somewhat, and it's gone from 19.4 trillion to 19.83 trillion. But that is contingent on continued weakness for the dollar. And one of the clearest and the most common prognostications by institutional investors is that the dollar is going to weaken. But one has to question against what? Because there is obviously this argument about the extent of the debts that are being accrued as a result of the fiscal expansion in the US. That's obviously something that should give anybody pause. Then you have the fact that because you have this fiscal expansion, then there's going to be a lot more debt issued. And there is a great deal of debt that needs to be refinanced starting this year. In fact, 2018 was a very slow year for refinancing, but then going forward into 2019, it could be anything from $400 to $600 billion worth of debt is going to have to be refinanced in the treasury markets. But then, of course, you're going to have the investment grade markets and the high yield markets. High yield does not really hit its peak for refinancing for another few years, but it's certainly going to start trending higher from here. And in fact, there was no new issuance of high yield bonds in December. Because yields were so high, there was nobody wanted them, and there was no company was willing to issue them at such high yields. So that's obviously one of the factors that is, I think, fueling this negative bearish this bearish outlook for the dollar. But when you think about a currency, you can never think about it in isolation. It's got to also be thought about against what you're converting it into. Well, the world's biggest currency pair is the dollar-euro, or euro-dollar. And the euro this week pulled back from the region of the trend mean again. And if the US has got problems, well, Europe's problems are greatly magnified. They have got this inherent contradiction to the currency that you have one monetary policy and 27 fiscal policies, and they have just ended their quantitative easing program. And that's, I think, one of the most important characteristics here, that if you look in 2014, the euro went from 140 to 105 in the space of about 8 months. And that was in response to the beginning of its quantitative easing program, where they added 2.6 trillion euros to their balance sheet. Well, there's nothing like 2.6 trillion euros of additional liquidity hitting the market to deliver an impressive advance. What the financial markets have been treated to over the course of the last decade has been one round of stimulus after another from various central banks. And the biggest question that we have in front of us today, it's the number one question that everyone should be asking, is that if this has been a liquidity-fueled advance, where is the next source of additional liquidity going to come from? Because we can talk about lots of other topics, but one of the things that David has been saying for decades is that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. And this is particularly pressing today because we just don't have an answer to that question. And that is why we have got this increasingly volatile environment. Now, if we look at the S&P 500 over the course of the last few decades, then we can see very clearly that it spent a good deal of time ranging in an extremely volatile manner between 2000 and approximately 2013. And then it broke upwards in a very emphatic fashion. And that advance has been really quite consistent until quite recently. Then we also know that the most consistent period in that chart was from the middle of 2016 through until the beginning of 2018. And now we have had more volatility. The market lost consistency at its penultimate high. It had a much larger pullback in January. It regrouped and then was pushing on to new high ground by September and then pulled back. Then it pulled back below the trend mean and ranged and did not sustain a move back above the trend mean. And now it has pulled back again and then unwound a good deal of that oversold condition, and it's right in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. One of the first examples we go through at the chart seminar is that past support becomes future resistance. And anyone who has shorting in December has got to be looking at this 2600 point level and thinking, well, golly, this was a previous area of support and then it was negated, so now this is a potential area to reopen short positions. And the price has paused here for the last three sessions. Now, this is the question, of course, is that having replaced a short-term oversold condition with a short-term overbought condition, are we then going to see it push up through this 2600 point level, or are we going to get some consolidation? And if it fails at this level, well then the big question everyone's going to ask is whether the low around the 2350 area is going to hold. So these are the big questions overhanging this market, and we are at the first area of potential resistance. The next area of potential resistance after this one will be the region of the trend mean. So that's an additional area where I think people will start to begin to ask questions. But what this also helps to really ram home the point is that we have had a major inconsistency. The imbalance between supply and demand that has been driving this bull market over the course of the last 9 years has obviously had a meaningful change. And it's not too difficult to ascertain what that change is. Well, we know that liquidity prices, availability of liquidity has contracted, that with the US raising interest rates, the price of borrowing has increased as well. And because the yield curve spread is very narrow, then banks are less inclined to lend. So we have a liquidity shortage. Well, if this was a liquidity-fueled bull market, and now we have a liquidity shortage, well, then that's why we're getting this much more volatile, tricky trading environment. And that brings us back to the question of where is the next round of stimulus going to come from? Well, let's start to go through the main providers of the liquidity that's helped to fuel markets over the course of the last 9 years. Well, the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. The Treasury in the USA is engaged in fiscal stimulus. There is talk of an infrastructure bill. Well, they're going to have to open the government before they can organize to get any bill passed. So that's certainly something that's out there on the horizon. But we don't have a great deal of evidence for it just yet. Now, the next question is when we look at Europe, the German economy looks like it is in recession. It had a negative growth number in the third quarter. It's quite likely it's going to contract in the fourth quarter. Now, if we look at the surplus that Germany has been enjoying, then we can see that it is expected to expand in 2018 and again in 2019 and 2020. And that could be really quite meaningful. But what I find particularly interesting is not so much the size of the surplus, but it's the size of the total expenditure, because Germany's expenditures are due to rise and rise meaningfully over the course of the next 5 years. So anyone who thinks that Germany is not or is never going to engage in fiscal stimulus needs to start looking at the future rather than the past. And these figures are assuming that there isn't a recession, whereas it's looking increasingly likely that Germany is going to move into recession. Italy is probably already in recession. France is not far away from it. France is also engaged in fiscal stimulus, and so is Italy, and indeed so is the UK. So there is the realistic possibility that the austerity mantra, which has dictated policy in the Eurozone for the last 6 years, could be abandoned. There is a reason why they adopted the austerity drive, and it was to prevent moral hazard. There is the clear ambition by the European Union to create a federal state, but in order to create a federal state, then sovereign debt would have to be pooled. And the only way that the creditor nations are going to even begin to countenance that potential is if debt to GDP ratios are all the same. The way to get those debt to GDP ratios all the same was to impose austerity and reform on the most recalcitrant spenders. So that's why the economies of Spain and Italy, Ireland, Portugal and Greece, Cyprus have had this massive austerity imposed upon them, and that the hope was that they would simply do what they were told. Well, you can't simply ask millions of people to accept lower standards of living for what must feel like indefinitely, especially when historically, they have relied on the weakness of their respective currencies to act as a shock absorber for their economies and to improve their competitiveness. Whereas right now, what they're being forced to do is to adjust their outlook and their regulations. And that's a very difficult thing to force upon people when you don't have a massive pickup in growth. And when you don't allow the banks to write off the debts, then you're going to have a big problem. That is the one clear strength the USA has. They went through the foreclosure crisis. They wrote off a lot of the debt. The financial sector in the US right now is in much better health today than it was in 2006, 7, 8, and 9. But the European banks are looking more Japanese by the day. They have not been allowed to write off their debts, and they are very much in zombie territory. Well, what that also really, I think, rams home the point is that Europe is in serious trouble, and the underperformance of the European markets is very notable. And most particularly when we just simply compare the outlook for the Eurostox index and look at that on a longer term basis. It's trending down. We have three higher reaction lows. And certainly we've had a meaningful pullback, and there's been some steadying over the last week. But this is not a particularly pretty chart. When we look at the Europe Stoxx 600, which includes the UK and Switzerland, Sweden and Denmark and Norway, then we're presented with a better looking chart. And arguably, this is the lower side of an evolving four-year range, but it would certainly need to hold these lows if the medium-term potential for a breakout is to be given any credibility at all. So we're at a very important level for the European markets in general. I do think that we are moving from a position of synchronized global monetary expansion to synchronized fiscal expansion. And Europe is going to play a very big, important part of that, if they can get their political wherewithal together to actually implement it. There is nobody under any illusion that this is not going to be difficult, particularly for Germany, because Germany has been able to come through the credit crisis and the sovereign wealth crisis comparatively unharmed. That doesn't mean, of course, that the German financial sector has been unharmed. That the fact that they've still got two listed banks may not remain the case for very much longer. I think when we look at, for example, the fortunes of Deutsche Bank, then the bank has been engaging in off-balance sheet shenanigans for decades, and now they're all coming back to bite it. This is still a very clear downtrend and a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs. And that's also a testament to just how much exposure Germany has to Europe in particular. But the underperformance of, for example, the auto sector is a very different story, because that's less a story about Europe and more a story about the world. Chinese auto demand contracted for the first time in 20 years in 2018. So the Chinese consumer, and I find this particularly interesting, but let me just, I suppose, stay first on point. I do think that Europe is going to move more towards fiscal stimulus, but it's going to be in a haphazard fashion. Now let's look at the Chinese market. I think the first thing is that when we look at the longer term history of the A-share index, then it's not a consistent trend. We don't have the kind of longer term rhythm that we have, for example, in Wall Street, which is characterized by long ranges followed by very impressive breakouts. What we have in China is these massive spikes on the upside, that when it goes, it really, really goes. And in between those occasions, it doesn't do much of anything. So what this also tells us is that big moves for the A-share index tend to be state-sponsored. So the big question now is, where is the next source of state sponsorship going to come from? Because the Communist Party has learned the lesson that by engaging in massive rounds of stimulus to save the economy after the credit crisis, they saw debt-to-GDP ratios surge higher. They've done whatever they can to boost the consumer economy, but the consumer economy is based on spending, and people don't spend if they have low confidence. So one of the things that a lot of people talk about with China is that the savings rate is very high, and it's in the order of anything from 20 to 30%, that the regular Chinese people have got trillions of dollar equivalents deposited in their banks, and that represents a significant source of fuel to really help to, combat the threat that is represented by the continued shackling of the shadow banking sector, the ban on US dollar denominated debt, and the cutting off of liquidity to both the corporate sector and the state-sponsored, or what perhaps would be better described as semi-state-sponsored, property and infrastructure building. The fact of the matter is that Deutsche Bank's derivative portfolio has probably got more in common with the kind of deals that go on in China than anything else. So one thing we can say is that the stock market is going down. Then when we look at the bond yields, well, bond yields are contracting, and they're not just contracting a little, they are accelerating lower. Well, bond yields don't go down in this fashion, falling from 4% to 3 and a bit%, without some reason. And that reason is quite clear. The global economy is slowing down, and the Chinese are weighing on the shadow banking sector. They're restricting credit. Now, what you see in the headlines is that they're reducing the reserve requirements. But reducing reserve requirements for banks means nothing if they can't then have that money available to lend. If that money is subsequently, locked up by meeting other obligations, then you haven't had a liquidity injection at all. So that's an important point. Now, there is an additional point, is if we look at, for example, the spread between US 10-year treasuries, and if we look at that just as a very simple metric, what we presented with is a very interesting set of circumstances occurred about 3 weeks ago, and it was probably more to do more probably about months rather than weeks, and it is regard to the simple difference between the yield on Chinese debt relative to the USA, because we're at a rather interesting juncture. When we think about the fact that we have Chinese debt where yields are contracting extraordinarily rapidly, and we have US debt where yields have been rising, well, there has to be some sort of relative value play between the two. And right now, the Chinese yields are contracting and US yields are rising, and the spread between the two is only 42 basis points. There was an occasion a couple of months ago when there was a negative, the last time we saw a negative level was back around 2007 and 2008. So these are interesting times, that when we think about the fact that US treasuries are rising, and what is the relative risk in terms of governance and in terms of the strength of the domestic economy, and not least the ability to not just put your money in but to get it out again, between the USA and China. When you have the stock market that is trending down, you have this massive demand for Chinese bonds, and then you have the renminbi, which declined abruptly last year. Now, the renminbi has certainly started to steady up, and it has at least confirmed support in the region of that 7 area. It's right now testing the region of the trend mean. But the Chinese don't want a stronger currency, and the stock market and the bond market tells us that it should really have a significantly weaker currency. So that's a major problem, because the one thing China is afraid of more than anything else is capital flight. All those deposits that are held in the state-owned banks that are used to support the entire financial system are obviously going to be very worried if the renminbi breaks below 7. And that's, I think, one of the more important points, that the renminbi is right in the region of the trend mean. If it rallies additionally from here, then the people that are thinking about a substantially weaker dollar will be vindicated. I don't think there's much chance of the dollar declining meaningfully against the euro, just simply because the European region has got so many challenges. But it is potentially, at least politically, viable that it could appreciate versus the renminbi. Or the renminbi could, appreciate against the dollar. So that's something that could be delivered as a result of the trade talks that are going on right now. But the other point is that if China's consumer economy has been boosted substantially by support from the government, the fact that they are moving much more towards a command economy, that that Xi now has his leadership for life, that they're moving much more towards an Orwellian view of how technology can be used to structure people's lives and get them to obey party doctrine, the setting up of inverted commas re-education camps, well, how long is it before that experiment in social engineering is expanded? So these are, I think, very important characteristics with regard to China. It represents a rather significant risk. I do think that China represents the epicenter of risk. And they have certainly been very clear in that they're not going to go for a big round of new stimulus. But what they have told us is that they are going to engage in tax cuts and more fiscal stimulus. So we're certainly going to get some form of fiscal stimulus coming through from China eventually. Now, the other big emerging market is India, and India now has a new central bank governor. Well, the Nifty index is hovering here right in the region of the trend mean. Just by virtue of going sideways, it's exhibited clear relative strength. Well, there's a strong likelihood that Modi is going to try and buy this year's election by, I think, engaging in fiscal stimulus. The fact of the matter is that his administration have been boosting their populist credentials ahead of the election. That I saw a headline that there is a risk that India will turn into a Hindu version of Pakistan. So that is, I think, representative of the fears of Hindu nationalism that is continuing and that are continuing to be stoked in an effort to boost the turnout for the election for the BJP. There's no question about it that it's a cynical move, but that doesn't necessarily mean it won't work, and it will certainly grease the wheels of politics if they do get a fiscal stimulus. So if we start drawing all of that together, then we're almost certainly at the end of the monetary stimulus party that's been going on since 2008 and 2009. That's one of the big changes. It could potentially be greeted by fiscal stimulus. We are definitely going to need another source of stimulus to really churn through this rather more difficult environment that we have on stock markets. Because in the absence of a new source of demand, then we would have to conclude that a top has been reached in the stock market. And if it's certainly a short-term top, it's definitely a medium-term top. But the question is whether it is a big top. Well, we haven't yet seen a deterioration in the wider economy, but that's a very shallow way of thinking about the market, because the stock market is a weighing measure, and it generally peaks well in advance of a recession taking hold. So we're at a very critical juncture, because we're at the first area of potential resistance. The other point is that when we think about the running down of the Fed's balance sheet, well, they're due to run off approximately $600 billion this year. So that's a significant quantity of cash. It's against a background where there's going to be a lot of treasury issuance. The big question now is what's going to happen in terms of these government bond yields. There is a wall of new supply that is due to hit this market, and yet the yield has contracted steadily from about 3.25% to 2.7% at present. Well, the big point is that it has sustained a move below the trend mean. it has failed to sustain the move above 3%. If we look at this on a longer term basis, 3% represented the upper side of the base formation. It has failed, and the dynamic of the failure has been larger than the dynamic of the breakout. So, in the absence of a clear and sustained move back above the trend mean, then we would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. Well, that suggests that when we think about this in terms of the price of these bonds, that this reversion to the mean that's underway at present, certainly there was a short-term overbought condition, well, that would suggest that there is potential here for additional upside in the bonds, and today's move was the first sign that support is starting to come through in the region of the upper side of this of the highs that were put in back in March and April. Well, if we see continued strength in the bond market against a background where supply is increasing, well, that will signal more than anything else that there is a lack of demand for risk assets. So there are certainly risks that are being exposed in the equity markets. That's, I think, the most important fact that we have at present. So I think that's certainly something that we need to pay due consideration to, that there is the potential here that if bonds don't pull back meaningfully soon, we would have to conclude that the downtrend over the last 3 years has been broken for yields and that for prices, sorry, and that the most likely scenario now is that we're going to get an additional rally. Well, if yields start to contract, then what are we going to have in terms of the stock market? The stock market has been worried about the fact that there has been less access to liquidity. Well, the big question is, where is the next source of liquidity going to come from? If we don't have the sources of liquidity helping to drive this market, we're going to have to see outsized economic growth and massive productivity gains. And those are out there on the horizon, but they're probably not evident in the very short term. So we can think about what is likely to happen over the next 6 months, that economic growth figures will contract because the runoff from the fiscal stimulus is going to occur. There are probably, as a result, going to be greater fears of a recession. I don't think that the USA represents the epicenter of risk on this occasion. That when we think about the outlook for the S&P 500, that generally speaking, when we get these extraordinarily impressive breakouts from very long-term ranges, then they tend to be supported for very long periods of time. And considering that the breakout was in 2013, this market has been going higher for 5 years. And generally, when you get a big breakout from a base formation, well, you can get it coming back down towards the lower side of, or the upper side of that underlying trading range. Well, that on the S&P 500 is approximately 1,600 points. So even in the event that this market crashes lower, and a crash to 1,600 or a move to 1,600 points would certainly be considered a crash, we could still make the argument that it's a secular bull market. Now, that is obviously not what investors want to hear. But it does tell us the magnitude of the asset price inflation that has occurred, that there is the realistic possibility that we are going to see that valuations contract as a result of earnings starting to moderate, but prices coming back faster. So I think when we look at what the Fed is doing, that they are probably going to stop raising interest rates, but they're going to persist in reducing the size of the balance sheet, that they are deliberately targeting asset prices. And that is not great news for the stock market. So that tells us that this is a very critical juncture. Well, that also, I think, helps. We should start to think about what is it that should do well in these kinds of situations. Well, Macy's, for example, pulled back extraordinarily violently yesterday, and it has now broken back below the trend mean. What that tells us is that there was a hiatus in terms of the retail apocalypse, but that it certainly isn't over, that the trend of online retail is going to persist and it's likely to intensify. So generally speaking, I think it's pretty simple that anything that can be sold online will be, and that the retail sector is going to be confined to the provision of services that can't easily be provided online. When I look at where I live, that less than half a mile away, there is a very large shopping mall that is now vacant, and there was news this week that it is going to be turned into a Google office. Well, quite apart from the fact that that is likely to inflate local asset prices in terms of housing, it's also a testament to the transition away from retail footprint that there is probably going to be a lot more service-oriented businesses spring up as a result of that change than there will be for the retail sector. Well, then, if we're really interested in what's going on with the retail sector, we really do need to look at what's going on with Amazon. And Amazon is right in the region of its trend mean. And it has had a very significant pullback. Well, Amazon is also the share where people have been the most conditioned to expect to be able to buy the dip successfully. So we do have evidence of people buying the dips. There have been very abrupt counter trend rallies in November and again in January. So now the question is whether it is going to be able to push back above the trend mean and to break the sequence of lower rally highs. And considering just how leveraged the Amazon price is to the continued growth in consumer demand, then that's a big question if we are seeing the global economy and the US domestic economy slowing. So these are not the kinds of shares we can really look to for continued outperformance. Then when we look at, I saw this chart today, I thought it was frightfully interesting. It was the number of publicly reported state-sponsored cyber incidents. And if we put aside for the moment the number and simply look at the trend, then this trend is accelerating higher. Well, if we need any other graphic representation of the growth in geopolitical risk, then cybersecurity is certainly part of that. This is a very meaningful change. That back in 2013, it was a non-issue. Today, there is nobody hasn't been affected by some sort of cyber breach. And this is probably going to get worse before it gets better. So when we look at the cybersecurity sector, it pulled back just along with the wider market. Just about everything pulled back. But cybersecurity is a sector that is probably going to do better in future if we finally do get a concerted security protocol imposed on just about all of the corporate sector. The amount of data that's been harvested about people gives the nefarious governments of the world a great deal of leverage if they choose to use it. And that's something that I don't think people are really paying much attention to. That what we've seen is that on isolated incidents, there have been cases of telecoms companies, hospitals, police departments being hijacked, and Bitcoin being demanded for ransom. But the wider problem is that just about all data is available for sale on the internet, that the ability to to really protect it is increasingly expensive. The reason that this sector hasn't done better is because it is cheaper for companies to endure a hack than it is to protect against one. When that eventually changes, and there is this, I think, the continued likelihood that it is going to change with rising geopolitical pressures, then this is a sector that could be a clear leader in any kind of recovery scenario. And the cloud computing sector is also likely to benefit in any kind of recovery scenario because they provide a productivity-enhancing service. And if you're looking at trying to save money, well, then that's a meaningful change as well. So I do think that we're going to see big changes in the leadership that we see in the market. And then we have the biotechnology sector. When we think about where is it that we're going to see growth and drive coming through in future, well, the commercialization of immuno-oncology is an incredibly exciting theme, and it is rapidly progressing. It's also moving on its own timetable rather than the market's timetable, and biotechnology is exhibiting relative strength right now. So after any big decline in stock markets, we have to first identify where is the relative strength. Now, if the stock market decline persists, then these sectors are likely to pull back in unison. But if we continue to see relative strength, then these are the sectors that will lead us up and out of this corrective phase. I think that is the clearest conclusion that we have right now. Now, when we think about the other sectors that are comparatively cheap, well, gold is sticking out as a relatively cheap asset class. And the price has been able to sustain this move above the $1,250 area. So this is a natural area where we can anticipate that we might get some consolidation. But the first area of potential resistance is the upper side of the range, which is just south of $1,400. If we do see the debt becoming an issue, then the competitive devaluation of currencies is something that has tended to be a very clear bullish characteristic for gold. And the fact that prices today are pretty much where they were back in 2012, or 2013, I think, to be more accurate, then that's, I think, a testament to the fact that nothing has been going on in the precious metal markets for quite a long time, and that they currently represent a comparatively cheap answer. The other important point is that one of the reasons why the USA is not the epicenter of risk is because the energy outlook has changed beyond recognition. Brent crude is currently around $60. It has bounced over the course of the last 2 weeks. And when we look at the chart, then we have a little downside key reversal in here today. If we get additional follow through on the downside next week, then we'll have a peak of at least short-term significance. The big question then is whether we'll get a higher reaction low and support starting to come back through around the $50 area. But the much bigger picture is that oil is in a secular bear market. The peak in oil prices was in 2008 around $140. We had a retest of that peak in 2011 and 12, and we had prices ranging above $100 for approximately 3 years. But there's a much bigger potential that we're going to see prices range between $50 and $80, or potentially even $30 and $80 for the foreseeable future. There was another interesting chart I saw today, and it was about the break-evens for the shale oil producers. And you can see two important points here. One is that it's a very wide band, but that on aggregate, the price of the break-even production price has been trending downwards for the last 5 to 6 years. but it's currently around $50 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate. So that tells us where the floor is going to be. Around $50 is where we can anticipate that there's going to be some demand destruction. The longer that prices hold below $50, the more demand destruction, excuse me, supply destruction, I'm sorry about that, supply destruction is what we'll see. The more of it, the more supply will get taken out of the market, the longer prices stay around $50. Well, then of course, we know that just about all shale producers are profitable at $80. So that's when they ramp up production. So it's going to be very difficult for prices to sustain themselves above $80, and particularly in view of the fact that the world's largest consumer has turned into a pretty much a break-even and is likely to become a persistent exporter over the next few years. That's an incredibly meaningful change for the US economy. It represents the reversal of significant outflows, and it's going to change the outlook for this the trade deficit just by virtue of the oil price. So that's, I think, a very meaningful change for the USA. It's one of the things that I don't see a lot of people talking about, that everyone is looking at the fact that deficits increased over the last few months because of the inventory build ahead of the anticipated ramp up in tariffs. But that's a relatively short-term consideration. The fact of the matter is that China is very clearly engaged in competition, and they're going to persist in competition until they get what they want. And if they fail, well, then we're going to end up with a much more nationalistic and inward-looking economy. The fact of the matter is that the Belt and Road Initiative and the Made in China 2025 is a very simple, or the simple analogy is to create an additional Iron Curtain. And this is I think we are at the end of the decades-long cooperation between the USA and China, that they are now competitive, or they are both economic and military competitors, and that this is going to persist indefinitely. If I was sitting in Taiwan, I would be very nervous right now, because the USA does not want China to develop a semiconductor business. China thinks it has a legitimate claim on Taiwan, and Taiwan has a very what has a world-class semiconductor in industry. So those are the really big points that if China is interrupted in its pursuit of a semiconductor business, then it could press its case militarily. So these are, I think, very important characteristics. When we think about the broad market in very simple terms, then we have additional risk premia that need to be priced in, and I think that the market is just about starting to do that now. So we're at a critical juncture. Either the trade war is going to get better, or we're going to see additional sources of new liquidity coming into the market, or we're not. And if we're not going to see that, then we're going to be in for a much more volatile trading environment for the majority of indices, because the issues that are arising as a result of decades of pursuit of increasing debt loads on the belief that bond yields could only go down, that's going to be challenged as we move through the I think key levels in terms of debt to GDP ratios, ability to pay, and taxation rates. The rise of populism has been a direct response to this clear inability of social democracy to improve standards of living for the majority. So that's also an awfully big change that is sitting out there and is continuing to evolve. So we are at very critical levels for the vast majority of asset price indices at the present moment, and they are badly in need of a clear catalyst for an additional run on the upside. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.